Good day, and welcome to the Westmount College conference call. Today's call is being recorded. Please be advised that your line will be muted throughout the duration of today's call. If at any time you have questions from today's presentation, please email all questions to questions@westmount.edu. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to President Gailey Beebe. Please go ahead, sir. Thank you.
Caroline, thank you. It's wonderful to be with you, and thank you for dialing in. We just anticipate an opportunity to communicate with you about where we are in all of the elements pertaining to the racial conversation on campus. We also want to give you an update on all of the plans for repopulating the college as we prepare to launch for fall semester. We'll spend some time doing Q&A, and then we'll pray. I want to begin by just highlighting some of the great influences on my own life. I come from a Quaker background, a Quaker upbringing, and I still have that very much in my life. I'm a recorded minister in the French church, and even though we haven't fellowshipped in a French church for 20 years, it was the most formative influence on my own understanding of our life with Christ. In that context, Martin Luther King Jr. was a hero to Quakers. He had utilized Quakers as one of the groups that joined with him in the civil rights movement. The Quakers published his letter from the Birmingham jail, and they funded the Poor People's Campaign. They also underwrote his trip to India, where he connected with some of the great places and artifacts from the life of Mahatma Gandhi. And so when I think about Martin Luther King Jr., I do so with a sense of the way in which he lived into his faith in a way that was an inspiration to millions of people worldwide, but especially people trying to follow the life of Christ in a way that could really matter. Now, one of the things that I have learned very recently is that there's a great effort to try and understand how best to appropriate people from the past who have influenced us, and how we can bring that into the present. I just hope that as a college community that we will retain a posture of continuing to learn, continuing to have a disposition to take in new information, and to change and adjust as we learn new things. One of the things that's happened recently because of the conversation, I've had an opportunity to reconnect with an alum, a black alum, and I initially called him an African-American, which is the phrase that I had used for much of my adult life. But when I stopped and just said, "What do you prefer?" he said, "I'm actually not of African ancestry." And he told me his own ancestry, and he said he prefers to be called black. Well, that was a teachable moment for me and a real learning. And as we go forward, I want the opportunity to reach out to our alums of various backgrounds and ethnicities, and really begin to understand both their experience at Westmount and how we can do a better job as we move forward. And when I think about Martin Luther King, I think about great individuals who have embodied the Christian faith. And he is certainly a martyr, one who died for his beliefs. But he lived such an amazing, inspirational life. And one of the many phrases that he certainly borrowed from others but gave a unique spin to it was, "What is the way in which a Christian should live their life?" And he said, the responsible Christian is one who has the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other. And by that he meant it was our responsibility to integrate the great experiences of life with the biblical testimony. Now, it was a call to consider, how do we bring our faith into contemporary society in a way that really counts? My own discipline, historical theology and philosophy of religion, really has wrestled with this from a philosophical and theological point of view. One of my favorite thinkers is Yaroslav Pelikan, who among his many works wrote the landmark study Jesus Through the Centuries, His Place in the History of Culture. What I like about this book is it identifies the 18 dominant ways Christ has been depicted throughout the 2,000-year history of the church. What I like in that is it helps us understand that there's a timeless aspect to Christ and a time-bound form in which Jesus is presented and the cultural thought forms of various communities around the world. And I think this is an important part of the conversation and that we'll have an opportunity to come to. A second aspect that we really have to take seriously is, at Westmont, how can we develop a greater capacity to listen? And part of this is developing a greater capacity to listen to the most aggrieved members of our community. And I want this to be something that we do to the best of our capacity, that we develop a empathetic orientation, a really essential, a capacity to feel what others have experienced. Now, I mentioned Pelican's work because one of the key questions has been the image of Jesus is portrayed in the stained glass window in the Nancy Bosco Memorial Prayer Chapel. The conversation around the window has prompted us to begin taking a fresh approach, not only to this sacred space, but to all spaces on campus. And conversations are underway and will continue into the coming year to contextualize both why the chapel was built and then what we need to do moving forward. Many of you already know that the chapel was built to honor Nancy Voskow, who was the daughter of then-President Roger Voskow. She was 19 years old, tragically killed in a car accident while returning to campus after lunch in December of 1959. Lisa DeBoer, our professor of art history who chairs the art department, has provided me with a wonderful history that reflects the original purpose and design of the chapel, and you can find it on our website. Because of my own background and my own discipline, I was especially curious about why the chapel had been constructed and why every piece of it is in the chapel as it's designed. There's some wonderful history here. But as the conversation has continued and as we've recognized some of the complexity of our contemporary moment, we've wanted to make some changes and begin the process of expanding the conversation and also expanding the repertoire of images in the chapel. And so Dr. DeBoer has actually crafted a wonderful process and approach that we'll be taking this year that's outlined in her document that's posted to our website. And if you go to the MICA Diversity Matters website, you can find it there. Essentially what Lisa has done for us is she's broken the conversation down into four categories that we're going to consider. And there's going to be a dialogue approach and then the crafting of some new images that will become a part of the chapel. And I do need to add that we have been in conversation with the Voskow family, with Nancy's two surviving sisters, Jane and Ruth, and they are very supportive of the approach and the process that we're taking. The four categories that Dr. DeBoer has identified are, one, Jesus Through the Centuries, the 2,000-year history of the church and its depiction of Christ. Two, the church year. How can we understand the church year through images? Three, the church around the world or global Christianity. And then four, the church at worship. Now, these are just preliminary. There's a lot of work to do, but I think this will be an exciting conversation with some really deliberate outcomes plan at the end. Second, I want to amplify just the importance of curricular innovations. And these, under the leadership of Provost Sargent, appropriate faculty committees have been meeting via Zoom and have approved a revitalized and repurposed ethnic studies minor. And I think this is just a really wonderful rekindling of something that's been at the heart of Westmont for many years. Several developments make this possible, including the ongoing hiring of persons of color on the faculty who are expanding and broadening our curriculum. Across the spectrum, professors from all disciplines are thinking anew about what it means to approach their discipline with fresh eyes, attentive ears, and curious spirits. And I really think this will be, the full implications of this will just be, I hope, inspirational for the college. There's so many good examples. One impressive one is the work of Professor John Blondell in our Theater Arts Department. And I would just encourage you to look at his work among many others as he really works to innovate his curriculum as part of this broader initiative. Another initiative is a college-wide implicit bias training. What I've loved about this concept is the way in which it brings to light the fact that we all carry subconscious prejudice, and we develop it without even realizing it. It's prejudice that we carry towards other individuals and groups, people that are different from us, people that live life and think about life differently than we do, and we're often ignorant of our own implicit bias. But thankfully, we have just some wonderful resources within our own community, including our own Professor Carmel Saad. Dr. Saad's a social psychologist and also the daughter of Egyptian immigrants who fled Egypt fleeing religious persecution. Dr. Saad's specialty includes teaching on implicit bias, and she has developed a national following. She is an amazing teacher, and she's going to take us through five sessions in the fall and five sessions in the spring, essentially considering an understanding of implicit bias, how to take a broader view of diversity, how to understand equity, how to be committed to inclusion, and what does it mean to develop intercultural competence. And I just look forward to the impact that she can have on us. One of the things I love about her style is she is so willing to be self-deprecating. She sprinkles a lot of personal stories, personal experiences with just evidence-based studies that illustrate her points and show that you can be tested for implicit bias. The fact that all of us have it, that we pick up subconsciously signals from the culture, and you really can't get to work on the subconscious messages from the culture until you've brought those to light and really become consciously aware of them. And so I look forward to that. Another initiative will be how do we continue to hire a more diverse faculty? Now, it's interesting that some questions and comments have been raised about this, and so I just want to give a stat. During my 14 years at Westmont, we brought in 58 new professors, often hiring as people left or retired, but also for new program initiatives. Of the 58 professors, 35 are women, 23 are men, and 17 are persons of color. And of these 58, 85% of them have stayed. A variety of people get involved in hiring faculty, including myself. But the provost is the one who leads the search. The relevant department chairs and appropriate additional members of the faculty serve on the search committees. And there's a full vetting. And so this doesn't happen quickly. But the fact that we have been able to diversify the faculty shows a multi-year commitment to this as a priority, and it will continue. And then I really want to amplify our focus on diversity, global engagement, intercultural competency in recruiting students. Like the faculty, we've been deliberately working at this the entire time I've been here, and it predates me. We could not hire the faculty, we could not recruit the students without just a great foundation which we've been able to build on. But in the past 14 years, the diversity of the student body has increased from a little under 30% to a little over 45%. All of this has taken time, effort, and significant increase in scholarship and money. But I so often think that we overestimate what we can get done in 1 year and underestimate what we can get done in 10. And we recognize that we still have a long way to go, but we do have some important and impressive progress that we've made. Then we also want to expand our access to resources. I'm delighted with the hiring of Blake Thomas as he begins to settle in as the director of ICP. I'm also pleased that Carol Houston, an African-American pastor, a black pastor from South Central LA, will be joining us. Carol serves on our Board of Trustees and has agreed to come to campus once a week, essentially to work on issues of diversity, global engagement, intercultural competence, and also as an advisor to me as we work our way through this. She has an amazing life story, an amazing faith story. She's been a pastor for many years at a church in South Central LA, and I just value both her friendship and her spiritual guidance. But I also want to encourage you to reach out for other resources. And here are some that have come to me that I have found especially important. Dr. Mark Strong is the pastor of Life Change Church in Portland. He produced a sermon that's been sent to me, and I just love it. And it was essentially a message to the white community from a black pastor. Just a powerful message from the book of Job. Daryl Williamson, the senior pastor of Living Faith Bible Fellowship in Tampa. And then a new friend of the college, Dr. Marcus Goody Goodloe from Wave Church in L.A. Dr. Goodloe is actually a Martin Luther King Jr. scholar, and he'll actually be coming to campus later this year. And then I mentioned Carol, pastor of Unspeakable Joy Church in South Central, and also Bishop Kenneth Ulmer of Water of Life Community Church in Fontana. And what I've enjoyed about these messages is it's really applying Scripture and helping us think through our biblical faith to a really complex, difficult, challenging social situation. And I appreciate the leadership, the thought leadership that each of these individuals are giving as we try to think together about how we can make headway on these big issues. In addition to these resources, we've also retained a gentleman by the name of David Bailey. And David's actually the founder and head of Erebon, an organization that works with various churches, colleges, universities, and other agencies, as well as for-profit companies, to try and build cultural understanding and work across all kinds of racial and ethnic boundaries. One of the things I've really appreciated about David, and he's a new friend of the college, is the way in which he works to engage us at a level that builds trust and helps lower barriers of suspicion between different groups. Now, there's other resources that we can also access. Another one that I've really enjoyed, Emmanuel Acho, a former NFL player, has started a podcast called Difficult Conversations with a Black Man. He gives some of the most user-friendly definitions of terms like white privilege. And the way in which he gets at the issues are so accessible. He's a former NFL player, went to University of Texas at Austin, and has returned to Austin, which is kind of his home base now. Another more controversial, Dr. Robin DiAngelo has written White Fragility, and it is really just an excellent book. It just gives a ton of great information, but it also has some highly controversial suggestions, conclusions, and observations. But it is a book that will help us understand the moment better. Later this fall, we'll also be hosting on campus a seminar with three people who are responsible for law enforcement in Santa Barbara County. District Attorney Joyce Dudley, Chief of Police Lori Lunau, and Sheriff Bill Brown. And together they're actually going to discuss with us how law enforcement happens in Santa Barbara County. I personally have high regard for all three of these individuals. I think they have been incredibly helpful, not only in this moment, but in terms of helping our community really have some of the most progressive policies in terms of how law enforcement is carried out so that we can have constructive engagement and not just have huge concerns about the integrity and ethics of our law enforcement individuals. I'm just grateful for them. As we move forward, or before we move forward, I really just want to emphasize again how important this conversation is to us, that all parties, all parts of the college community are going to be involved in it. And I hope that throughout the year that we can exercise patience and forbearance with one another as we learn to live together with difference, learn to respect difference, but also make significant headway on such a critical issue. And before we go on, I'd like to stop and pray and just pray for this moment in the life of the college. Gracious Lord and God, we give you thanks for all that is occurring, that it can bring to the surface the many ways in which we have neglected or overlooked problems that are a part of our life and our society. Westmont is an important part of this conversation. and help each one of us who plays a role at Westmont to play our role well, to be able to bear with one another, to express forbearance in a way that actually encourages conversation and cultivates meaning. We just pray that you'll guide us during this moment and that we can look back on this time as a turning point in the life and thought of the college and one that really produced great fruit. We pray these things in your Son, Jesus Christ's name. Amen. Well, with that, we're going to pivot to our conversations about COVID-19 and how we're planning to respond. We are in the process of prepping for the August opening with new students arriving on August 27th. We will be going through plans, and each of the VPs and provost are here to give you a brief overview, because we actually produced a document, a planning document. It had 150 people, 50 different committees and subcommittees, and it goes to over 150 pages long, and we'll be submitting that to the county public health official. Nevertheless, for our purposes tonight, we'll officially open for students on Thursday, August 27th. Student leaders, athletes are coming back earlier than that. We've got some testing protocols that we've got to communicate tonight. We've got to be clear about access to campus. We're going to go through all of the plans by areas for housing, classrooms, dining commons, and so on. And then we need to just be mindful. We really believe a vaccine's on the way, and so we've got to figure out how to get through fall semester. And so I think it's very likely that it'll require our best effort, our best discipline to make it through fall semester. But I think we can have a glorious spring, and I just really hope that we'll keep that in mind as we basically embrace this. And just before I turn it over to the VPs for them to begin going through their work, I do want to remind you that what I've shared tonight will be posted to our website immediately following the call. And you can go to the call, or pardon me, to the website to find the material. And then it'll also be featured in the upcoming issue of the Westmont magazine that you should get sometime in the next 2 weeks. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mark Sargent, our provost, who will begin talking about our academic program.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, President Beebe. I'm going to take a few minutes here to highlight some of the planning that's gone into our academic program for the fall, as well as our athletic program. I want to assure you that the academic program is going to be adhering strictly to the CDC guidelines for physical distancing. And that is that we will make sure there is sufficient space in classrooms for students to spread out to minimize the risk of transmission. That's required us to assign many courses to new spaces. We'll even be using some larger spaces like the gym and Page multipurpose room. Some professors will be even using some outside spaces for some of their class sessions. We'll have a small group of classes, under 30, that will be offered entirely online. Another 15 or 20 will be offered in some kind of hybrid form. That is usually where half the class attends one day and the other half participates remotely, and then they reverse that. The hybrid approach will also be used in some of the labs so that fewer students will be in the lab at one time. The full list of our courses, including their new room assignments and their particular modality, in other words, whether they're going to be online or hybrid or as usual, is going to be posted on WebAdvisor by noon on July 15th. So we encourage you to check after noon on July 15th to see the up-to-date information. Faculty, by the way, are going to be receiving an email from the provost's office this week with additional information about our plans. If you check the schedule on WebAdvisor after July 15th, you will see that we are adding an additional 5 minutes between classes in the mornings and in the early afternoons. So there's more time for cleaning and more time for transit between classes. Our approach to teaching in the fall will be as usual. We're going to continue to prioritize the relational residential education that's really core to our mission as a Christian liberal arts college. And as we prioritize the relational aspects of our educational philosophy, we will be especially mindful of the additional challenges our students are facing. We're going to take great care to make sure that students who need to quarantine for any reason will not lose ground in their ability to make progress in their class. We'll be maintaining a commitment to providing sufficient office hours through various modalities so that students have access to faculty. And we'll be constantly updating the core team, the care team, about students who may be struggling or need some additional help. There will be advising sessions for new students. Some of those initial sessions will be done individually through remote means, and there'll be some department, larger group sessions as well. Just a few notes about some other academic areas. The Westmont Downtown and Westmont San Francisco programs will be proceeding as scheduled, although those programs have been adapted to limit students' interaction with their city context. And we'll be making a decision about the Westmont Jerusalem program by October 1st. And decisions about May-term international programs will be made by mid-year. Most of our internships for the fall are going to be handled remotely, and for those that are not, that we'll have on-site, those sites are going to be reviewed by our Office of Institutional Resilience. We are planning for music courses that will observe the recommended standards of 6 feet apart for all students who are working with instruments and 14 feet for voice. A few of our private lessons are going to be conducted remotely. As far as performances, we are planning for live streaming and pre-recorded streaming concerts for the fall season. And we'll have a mixture of some professionally produced presentations as well as some that we will do here on campus. There'll be some theater productions that will also be done on film, as well as various network techniques. We're taking great care in our library to make sure that there is appropriate space between those who use the library. Carrels and chairs and tables will be moved apart. Several pieces of furniture will be removed. And the books that are returned will be quarantined to make sure that we minimize the risk of infection being passed on. Now, I do want to assure you that our Office of Disability Services, our Writer's Corner, and many of the services that we provide are going to continue to operate. They'll continue to provide tutoring and services remotely, and they're going to be very proactive about reaching out to students to who need assistance, since drop-in traffic will not be as frequent this year. Let me shift briefly to athletics. The athletic department has developed a return-to-campus plan for the fall sports teams that's being reviewed by coaches and medical professionals. We're working closely with the National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics, the NAIA, and our conference, the Golden State Athletic Conference, to ensure safe participation by our athletes and by our opponents. We need to make sure our guidelines fit into the national and local guidelines. And our protocols are still being worked on as we work with these organizations. But I can make a few assurances. One is that testing and tracing and communication between competing institutions will be hallmarks of our safety protocols. Any athlete who tests positive for COVID will be required to have a negative test before they can return to practice or to play. Westmont will be complying with the requirements of state and county officials, and currently organized sports are not allowed in the state of California under the governor's order. The county of Santa Barbara is under this order, so no live play is currently allowed. We are hopeful that the order will be lifted in the coming weeks, but our ability to hold fall sports does require us to have the governor's order lifted. At the present time, the NAIA has identified August 15th as the first day when an official practice can be allowed. And, of course, that will only happen if the governor's order is lifted. And the NAIA has identified September 5th as the first day when games will be allowed to be played. Just a final word here. This is obviously a very dynamic situation, and we need to continue to monitor the regulations and decisions of local and national organizations before we can announce firm plans. Athletes have been in contact with their coaches on a regular basis, And if any athletes or parents have questions about the fall seasons or Westmont's preparations, they should start by contacting their coach or the athletic director, David Odell. The coaches and your athletic director will be able to provide the most up-to-date information. Okay, thank you.
My name is Edie Schulze, and I'm Vice President for Student Life, and I am delighted to provide you with some updates related to orientation, residence halls, various things like that. First off, let me say that we are into learning, and this is an opportunity for us to learn to live differently and to live on campus with each other in ways that we haven't had to do before. So I had a friend once who said, if you can't get out of it, get into it. So we're going to get into it because we are with COVID for a little bit. Let me start by saying orientation for new students is going to be happening predominantly online. We are so looking forward to having our new students with us, our transfer students, our first-year students. They will begin arriving on August 27th and continue through the 28th. You'll be receiving particular times for your move-in from the orientation team. Also, please keep checking your emails for updates, looking specifically for the faculty advising that Mark mentioned, the Canvas course for new students that gives information about aspects of Westmont's experience that you won't want to miss, and then the Lunch and Learn series, which is happening this month, introduces new students to various departments. When you come to campus, we are asking students to bring no more than two people with them for move-in. We love that parents will be able to come, parents or family members will be able to come and experience that important time, but we do ask that you limit the number of family members that you bring to two. And we also are hoping that by the end of move-in day, your family members will be able to return home. We are trying to maximize our space for social distancing, so we are asking parents and families to leave campus by the end of their students' move-in day. We'll be screening people who come to campus for COVID symptoms, and Doug's going to be talking about that a little bit later in the call. Continuing students may move into the residence hall beginning on Saturday, August 29th, and you'll be receiving some information from Residence Life about the particulars of that. Some facility adjustments that we've made is we will not have any triples in Page. If you're a new student and you have requested to live in a triple, John Young, our Director of Housing and Parking Services, will be in touch with you to work that through with you. The sinks will have plexiglass partitions between them in order to help prevent the spread, any spread of COVID. In the rooms, there will be curtains to divide the bed spaces, similar to a shower curtain or something like that. It won't affect the egress or the entrance into the room, but it will help provide a physical marking between the room to keep help keep students a little bit separated in their rooms. We do ask that if you're thinking about bringing an air purifier, especially one that utilizes UV light, that you communicate with Jason Tavares, who's our Director of Institutional Resilience. Air purifiers need to be approved before they can be installed in the res hall room. Some of them are safe, others are less safe, and we're also concerned about the electrical pull that will put onto our system. As we get closer to when students come back to campus, there'll be more specific protocols coming your way. In terms of living in community, much like you live in a family unit at home, we are asking students to consider their rooms to be a pod. And you've probably heard that word on the news. Essentially, it means that you are working together to keep your living space safe, and you're considering the other person as someone within your, quote, family unit or your pod. Residence hall kitchens will be available for use by students, but we will have some restrictions on that. We will have a no off-campus visitor policy in the residence halls. Now, that said, we do want parents and families, particularly of new students, to be able to come and visit their student if that's necessary. We ask, though, that you consider the possible impact of your visit on the Westmont community. We'd love to have our students stay connected with their parents, especially our first-year students, but we are also trying to be conscious about how the virus could spread very quickly on our campus, so we ask you to use discernment about that. Faculty, staff, and students will be asked to abide by what we're calling a covenant for COVID. It's currently being written. And we want to emphasize that our ability to live well together will depend very much on each of us doing our very best. And we want to provide some guidelines and then just appeal to everybody's good sense of being a good neighbor and using practicing good hygiene and using masks and social distancing. We will have provisions for quarantine and isolation for students who are suspected or have come in contact with someone who's suspected with COVID, if they test positive or if they are suspected of having COVID. More details on that will be coming out soon. It will include things like meal delivery and helping students with laundry and that sort of thing, but we're being very attentive to that process. Chapel is an essential part of the Westmont experience, and we love that we gather together three times a week. It's part of being here at Westmont. This fall, at least for September, chapel will be online, and students are going to be expected to attend chapel virtually. And then we're going to ask you to self-report your participation. And I'll say that we have a real strong lineup this fall, so you definitely will want to be a part of it, but we're going to ask you to use the honor code to report your participation in chapel because it's so important to us. Things like WAC and clubs, organizational activities will be virtual or in small groups, and we're also being really attentive to how we can support our students emotionally during the COVID, during our COVID adaptations. Different people have different needs and different levels of comfort, so we are providing through our CAPS, Counseling and Psychological Services area, as well as our health center, the support our students will need. For students who are anticipating internships, we hope that these internships will be conducted virtually, and each of the internship sites will have to be approved on a case-by-case basis. So that's it for student life, and I'm going to turn it over for operations with Doug Jones.
Thank you, Edie, and good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining the call tonight. My name is Doug Jones. I'm the Vice President for Finance here at the college, and would love to spend a few minutes with you talking about some of the operational impacts and changes of the COVID preparation for the fall. Let me start with COVID testing. This is maybe the most frequent question that we've been getting in recent weeks about what testing will look like on campus as we begin coursework in the fall in August. And we do intend to test everyone. Let's begin there. We've outsourced our testing to a company called ExcelTox, E-X-C-E-L-T-O-X. And we'll have their trained technicians on campus for several days in August to test everyone. We're going to break it up into a few different components, so faculty, staff, and several of our early arrival students, which would include athletes and other student leaders, will be tested the week of August 17th. We should have results back within a day or two on how those tests went. New students, first-year students or transfer students who move in on August 27 and 28, will be tested as they arrive on campus, and then any remaining students, returning students who hadn't been tested yet, will be done on August 29 and 30, and again, we'll have those results in a couple of days, so we'll be able to establish a clean baseline as we begin the semester. We anticipate that these will be the nasal swab tests, although we got some good news today that we may be able to do the saliva cheek swab test, which would be a bit quicker and just a little bit easier to administer for folks. So we'll anticipate that progressing through the summer and have good news there. So each of you who either works on campus or will be going to school on campus will receive an email from ExcelTox in August asking you to set up an account with them. And essentially what that will allow you to do is as they the results come back from your test, they will post those results to your account. So you'll have opportunity to then go log in, check, see how your test came out, obviously positive or negative. The college will also receive a master list of everyone who took the test, and we'll have an opportunity then to see, again, who all tested positive or negative. And obviously, we're hoping and praying for all negative on those first tests. We do anticipate additional COVID testing throughout the semester. So again, this first test will be everyone essentially at the same time. But as we move through the semester, we're going to do periodic testing, random testing, about a third of the campus each of the 3 months of the semester, so September, October, November, so that everyone will have an opportunity to be tested twice throughout the fall semester. Moving now to daily health assessment. So it's one thing to do the test. The tests tell you on that day that you took the test whether you had COVID or not. But how do we actually continue to keep the environment and the community healthy as we move through the semester? And we're really going to move to a daily health assessment that you will really conduct on yourselves each morning. So we're really going to ask you two basic questions. Do you have a fever? So is your temperature 100.4 or higher? And do you have any COVID-related symptoms? And to administer this, we're developing an app. We actually are testing the application right now. It's been in test mode for about a week and a half or 2 weeks now. I've been using it every day. It's very simple to use. Takes maybe 5 seconds to record your results. And then that creates a master result back to our Director of Institutional Resilience. And also will trigger an email to you. So you'll get an email that says, hopefully, that says, you've passed your test. You get to come to campus today. If for some reason you answer yes to either of those questions, that you either have a high fever or you have COVID-related symptoms, you'll be receiving an email that asks you not to come to campus. Or if you're on campus as a student, just ask to be stay in your room for the remainder of the day until the symptoms subside. We would encourage students just to streamline the process. If you have a thermometer or could obtain a thermometer before you come to campus in the fall, please go ahead and do that. We will have thermometers, touchless thermometers, and other temperature scanners available to capture temperature information, but just certainly to streamline things, it would be just a little bit easier if you did bring a thermometer, so we'd encourage that as well. The campus has put together a social distancing protocol, a written protocol. This has been posted on the website since late May, so perhaps you've seen that if you've taken some opportunity to look at our COVID site. I won't go into all the details. It's there's a lot of information there, but this may maybe boil it down to a few key areas. And essentially, it's going to ask us all to wear face coverings, to do appropriate physical distancing, the minimum six-foot physical distancing, and to do regular and routine hand washing. All three of these are crucial to keeping the community healthy until we have a vaccine in place. And so we really want to encourage that of everyone, all faculty, staff, and students, to maintain this and follow that social distancing protocol. It really, again, begins to lay out how we should expect one another to live and work in a safe environment throughout the course of the fall. Shifting now to contact tracing. So what happens if someone on campus has suspected COVID or actual COVID or maybe has been in contact with someone who has COVID? Once that word reaches our Director of Institutional Resilience, Jason Tavares, that will trigger our contact tracing protocol. We've got 4 people trained through the Johns Hopkins training program right now. We anticipate having 10 folks trained before the start of the semester. We'll call those folks into service, if you will, and ask them to be on the phone with the person who was in one of these categories, either suspected or actual COVID, and really just ask a variety of questions to trigger the individual's memory along the lines of where have you been and who have you been with these last several days. We'll take that list of information, and then those individuals doing the tracing will contact those individuals that you identify to us and just alert them to the fact that they may have been in contact with someone who has suspected or actual COVID. And then, again, kind of work down through the train of who have been they then been in contact with in the last several days where there, again, may have been exposure or potentially some contagion there. So really it's our best way to limit the spread of COVID if it does come to campus, if we can catch it early, and ask those who potentially have been exposed to it to self-isolate in their rooms or if to faculty or staff member to stay home until such time that they're cleared either through getting a negative test or through enough days having elapsed with no symptoms that they can then come back to campus. So I would just ask and implore you that if you do receive a call from one of our Westmont contact tracers, please take a few minutes and speak with them. It'll be important for you, important for your friends, important for those you've been with, and able to enable the community to keep any COVID at bay. Next, let me shift to cleaning protocols. So Westmont has developed a set of written cleaning protocols for the campus, both in general terms and also in specific spaces, specific use spaces. And really what it comes down to is being a partnership between the college's custodial department and faculty, staff, and students who will actually be inhabiting the spaces around campus. So disinfected surfaces are really an important tool in slowing the spread of the virus, and so the best way to do that is just really constant cleaning. So our custodians will be through every space at least early in the morning, early in the day. In many spaces that are highly trafficked, they'll be through again later in the afternoon to clean on surfaces. We're also going to ask faculty and staff to clean with disinfectant wipes, just basically a Clorox wipe type of a product. Their offices, their desks, their suites, their departments, those sorts of things. Classrooms, for students, we're going to ask them to keep the residence rooms clean and help us keep the bathrooms clean in the residence halls. Obviously, the custodians will be in there daily, 7 days a week, in fact. But between cleanings, it'll be important for the students to help us keep the space clean and disinfected. We have a number of our students have been trained on a number of cleaning products, and one of the products we've shifted to recently has extended life in terms of its ability to kill the virus, extending up to 8 hours in length. So if they clean early in the morning, it should have good disinfecting properties throughout most of the day. And then in rooms where we may have actual or suspected COVID, we have purchased a number of units that will turn liquid cleaners into a mist or a fog and allow that to be applied to places that are maybe more difficult to reach or surfaces that are just difficult to disinfect without these sorts of measures. And then that'll allow us to get these spaces cleaned up and back in service in fairly short order. Can assure you that we have investigated all of these cleaning products, and they are completely safe to the inhabitants of the spaces. Obviously, the custodians have been trained, and they'll wear appropriate protective equipment as they apply it, but it's certainly once it's been applied, it's completely safe for the occupants. As Edie has mentioned, access to campus is generally going to be limited to those who have a need to be on campus. This will include opportunity for guests to be here, but we certainly anticipate that most of those guests will have scheduled time on campus, scheduling in advance so we know how to plan appropriately. And we do will ask visitors to abide by the same health assessment questions and guidelines that our faculty, staff, and students are being asked each day. Finally, on the dining commons, I'll just touch on one last point here. The dining commons will be open for meals. It will look and feel just a bit different than you may be used to. We've gone to a touchless system here where effectively as you walk into the dining commons, you'll receive a bag. In that bag will be a to-go container, prepackaged utensils, condiments, sanitary wipes, those sorts of things. So you can clean your hands, clean your table if you like, before and after you eat. You'll come through the line, socially distanced, of course, get the food that you like, and then you'll exit the building and have opportunity to sit under one of several tents that we'll have placed on lawns around campus. Or if you want to just take it back to your room, you can certainly take it back to your residence hall, take it back to your office, and have your meals there. There'll be a lot more details to come on that as we get closer to the start of school, but for the call this evening, I think that's probably enough detail on the operational aspects of a campus, and we'll look forward to giving you more details and posting those to the website shortly.
This is Reed Sheard, and I serve as the Vice President for College Advancement and the CIO. In my CIO role, I have responsibility for technology, and I wanted to provide a brief update on what we're doing to support the curricular and co-curricular endeavors of the college in the fall semester. I'll begin with the most important topic, Wi-Fi. The campus interconnection and every Wi-Fi access point across the entire campus, this would number more than 500, are being audited with upgrades and fixes being applied throughout the summer. This is being done to help ensure wireless service is functioning at the highest level of availability and performance across every area of campus prior to your arrival. To assist in this endeavor, to provide the best possible wireless experience, students and staff and faculty will be required to meet minimum operating system requirements for notebooks, smartphones, and iPads, and more on these requirements will come from IT later this summer. IT is also working on increasing the amount of internet bandwidth made available to Westmont. And while I don't have something to report tonight, progress is very promising, and we're confident that we'll be able to have more bandwidth available for the campus to share. This will help with the overall performance as more academic and co-curricular content is shared via the internet. IT is also working to support the new Wi-Fi 6 standard this fall. This will make Westmont one of, or perhaps the only school in the country to have campus-wide support for Wi-Fi 6. The new Wi-Fi 6 standard is more than 3 times faster than previous wireless protocols. And as people get devices that support this standard, the Westmont Wireless Network will be ready. Since internet capacity is a finite and shared resource for our entire Westmont community, the decision has been made to limit internet traffic between the hours of 7 a.m. and 5 p.m. to be reserved primarily for academic and institutional priorities. All services will work, but academic and institutional priorities will take precedent. From 5 p.m. to 6 a.m., other traffic will be supported, such as gaming, Netflix, Amazon Prime Video, YouTube, and the list goes on. Two-factor authentication, and you've all probably had experience of this. If you get a new, say, Apple device, your old Apple device texts you with a number that you have to enter in, that is two-factor authentication. And this will be required for access to Westmont Gmail and other Google-hosted services such as Google Docs, Google Groups, and others. While this represents some level of inconvenience, it is necessary to combat the increased security threats that have emerged during COVID-19. This will help protect your data and your personal information. IT will have more information about this requirement later this summer, and will work to make this as convenient as possible. To echo comments from Doug Jones, the computer labs will be available and cleaned on a schedule as determined by a facilities team, to ensure that the technology that the college provides is safe and available for your use. Printing. Printing stations will be expanded and decentralized to help with social distancing and to provide easier access to college printing services. The plan is to make printing available at various locations across campus in addition to printing in the library, and this will be in place prior to the beginning of the fall semester. Lastly, in my role in heading up Advancement, which is the fundraising arm of the college, I would just like to end with saying and offering a heartfelt thank you. Early in March, when COVID-19 pandemic was just beginning to become real to all of us, we reached out and asked for help to our Westmont community. So many of you, from alums to parents to faculty to staff, trustees, college leadership, and boards, all stepped forward to help with the costs of responding to COVID-19. All told, more than $300,000 has been contributed to the COVID-19 Emergency Relief Fund. We will continue to raise funds to support the safe opening of the campus, the plans that you've heard tonight. But I wanted to extend a heartfelt gratitude on behalf of myself as the Vice President for this area, on behalf of President Beebe, on behalf of the executive team of which I serve, as well as the entire community of Westmont. When we asked you to step forward, you did. Thank you.
Okay, let me begin to work through some of the preset questions that have come in, and we'll just continue until we reach the conclusion. First up, with the current resurgence of COVID-19 cases and increased restrictions on indoor activities called for in several counties, including Santa Barbara County, is it wise to even consider reopening this fall on the currently planned schedule or opening at all? We actually do believe that it's very wise to consider and continue to plan to reopen. There's an excellent article by the president of Cornell University that demonstrated that college students are actually safer being at college where they can be tested, they can be traced, they can be isolated than being on their own, and in fact it decreases spread by tenfold.
And so we believe as a school our size, we're the perfect size to really address this, to allow the students to continue their life and their education, and to really handle it in a way that gives them the greatest likelihood of preserving their health during this period of time. The second question, what should international students plan for if there are immigration concerns being raised about remaining in the U.S.? And Edie Schultze, our VP of Student Life, will answer that.
Yeah, the news has recently come out that any F-1 visa students who are in the country need to be enrolled in some kind of face-to-face class in order to remain here in the United States. Since we will be meeting in hybrid and in-person situations, our students who are from other countries are not in danger of being deported from the United States.
Okay, the next question. Can we help our returning students move into their room? We know we'll need to buy certain items for the room, so we'll have to return with our student after buying those items. Is that possible, or do we only get a one-time visit on campus during our move-in day?
Yeah, as we've talked about, we want people to be careful when they come to campus. We want them to consider if the visit is essential. If you can meet another way, that's better, but we will not prevent you from coming to campus. We just want you to use discernment when you come.
Okay, thank you, Edie. Next up, will students be required to remain on campus once tested?
Again, we want to discourage all non-essential travel. So if students need to go off campus from time to time to get groceries, that's fine. If they need to go home for a family emergency, that's fine. But we're really going to be encouraging our students to limit their non-essential travel.
How does Westmont plan to maintain a student in quarantine and get them the necessary services, i.e. the food and fluids they'll need, without having them leave their rooms if they come down with COVID?
Yeah, we are working on the details of that. More information will come out as this month moves along and we finalize exactly how that's going to happen. We did this successfully in the spring with the number of students who were here. We fed them. We provided opportunity for, of course, bathroom and restroom use. We helped them with their laundry and all of those sorts of things. And so I have a high degree of confidence that we'll be able to do that again. I don't want to speak too much in advance of finalizing the details, but we are definitely working on that, and we'll have more to come.
Edie, when are room assignments going to be made for new students?
Yep, around July 20th, so you can look for that information then.
Okay, are UVC lights and lamps safe for use in student rooms? What kind are safest? And Jason's going to address this one.
Thank you, Dr. Beebe. Many of you have heard of UVC lights that are used to kill biotic materials in the air. The most common ones that you see are 222 nanometer and 254 nanometer bulbs. The 222 nanometers, there was an article that came out in Nature that said that those are pretty safe relative to the 254 nanometers. So as you are looking for UVC lights, I would urge you to do the 222 nanometer. They're also known as far UVC. The 254 are a little bit more likely to have serious health effects, especially depending on exposure. But prior to any UVC lights being utilized in the room, I'd ask that you reach out to the Office of Institutional Research so we can verify what kind of light it is and make sure that it's safe for use in your dorm room. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jason. I'm curious about the filtration systems in the dorm rooms. Aren't many of the dorm room buildings very old? With students in such close proximity and breathing the same air, will these systems be updated? Doug, would you answer that?
Yeah, you bet. So the buildings in which there are systems that recirculate the air, those systems have been set to 100% outside air. So they're not recirculating air. They're pulling in all outside air, and then that air is heated or cooled depending on what the system will do. Now, many of our residence halls, as the question pointed out, are old enough that they don't have those kinds of systems. And we're really going to just encourage there that students have windows open. And maybe that's, you know, wider or narrower, but essentially leaving windows open most of the time to allow some draft through, allow some airflow through, and that's really the best option there.
Okay, thank you. Are homecoming and commencement happening the same weekend on campus? At this point, yes. We're fully planning October 16, 17, and 18 to be both homecoming and commencement. And then we just have to continue to plan. Questions have come in about other formats that might be used, and we'll just have to see what the county will allow as we continue to make plans. Is Parents Weekend canceled? To my knowledge, it's full steam ahead. Reed, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, Parents Weekend will happen with a lot of virtual activities, and more information will be coming out of that office from Sarah Camp, C-A-M-P. Look for information from her.
And it's scheduled for the first weekend, the Friday, Saturday of November. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And one of the features we have, we're scheduled to have John Meacham, the famous presidential historian, on campus that Friday. Obviously, it's unlikely that he'll make it since there's no vaccine available yet, but we're in negotiations with his agent to actually do a broadcast, and so we're hoping to combine that, which would also be available virtually. So I think that'll make for a good experience. Will Westmont provide rebates for room and board if the college has to close for COVID? Doug, would you comment on that?
Yeah, you bet. Yes, so if the college does need to close for COVID, whether that's an internal decision or whether that's a county-mandated decision, we will do prorated refunds on room and board for fall semester.
When do you expect the COVID-19 plan for fall semester to be posted to Westmont's website? We're not going to post the entire plan. It's over 150 pages. Currently, it's 158. We will be posting updates or frameworks, overviews, outlines as needed or as requested, but we won't be putting the whole report up. Will there be any online classes available for students who don't want to return to the campus?
Yes, this is Mark Sargent here. As I mentioned earlier, we do have a little under 30 online courses that we will be offering. So if a student has interest in studying remotely, we ask that you get in touch with the provost office. We would like to learn more about the circumstances, and we can talk to you about what the possibilities would be with your schedule. So feel free to contact the provost office.
We will be really wanting to ensure the community on campus, and so that'll be a very delicate situation. We realize that some people have unique medical needs, and so we'll want to take those into consideration. Will the fall semester close by mid-November, i.e. before Thanksgiving, with students returning in January? At this point, no. Anything is possible, but we're going to start classes on August 31. We will take Thanksgiving break. There's going to be conditions, like if you leave the state of California, you'll have to get back in time to get retested. The protocols that we're using to manage the campus will continue, and we will continue through the end of the semester as scheduled in December. Again, we've got to stay in conversation with the county, whatever the governor and the county health officer allow. Some have asked, why didn't we go to the Notre Dame schedule, which was the August 10th start and finish before Thanksgiving? Right now, we're hoping we get to open by August 31, and so we're glad we have the extra runway. And then I'd remind you, we lived in Michigan for 7 years, about a three-hour drive from South Bend, Indiana, and it is colder by November 1 in South Bend, Indiana, than it ever gets in Santa Barbara. And so we just live in an ideal climate, and if the COVID manifestation is tied at all to weather-related patterns, which we're not sure it is, we should be okay. So we're not planning to modify the calendar. Okay, will there be any states considered as a must-quarantine 14 days when arriving in California? Jason, we'd like you to answer this one.
Do that one more time, sorry.
Yeah, will there be any states considered as a must-quarantine 14 days when arriving in California?
Thank you, Dr. Beebe. At this time, there's been no talk of excluding any state travel into California. The tri-state area was really moving towards that decision because of their lowering cases and hospitalization rates, and everything was looking much better in their area. So they were putting up that barrier to help protect New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. California, unfortunately, is not looking great right now, so we don't really have the same kinds of concerns.
Will Compex day groups be permitted to gather in person? In all likelihood, yes, provided they can socially distance 6 feet. And we'll be very careful with that, but those are groups that are small enough that they can actually do that. What precautions will be taken to ensure food being served to students hasn't been contaminated by a sneeze and a cough? Jason can amplify this. There's plexiglass being installed everywhere. And so, Jason, you want to amplify what you're doing?
Absolutely. There are at various checkpoints throughout campus, wherever there are public-facing areas, so meaning an employee is facing the public while they're trying to do their job, be it in an office or in the dining hall, there are plexiglass barriers that are being installed. Additionally, everything that we've seen regarding COVID infections shows that if you ingest it via just through your food or anything like that, there is really no chance of infection because your stomach acids actually break down the COVID material in your food. So as far as any kinds of transmission or anything like that, we're not that concerned with it from that perspective.
Jason, great answer. Thank you. Okay, basically any other questions that come in from this point on, we will post to the website. So if you had a question that you wanted to send, we'll try to respond to it. I just want to emphasize, more than anything, we want to repopulate the campus. We're preparing for that right now. I participated today in our Trailhead program, which is kind of an experimental way. I had to fill out Jason's nicely crafted form. I had to take my own temperature and record it. And so it's really nice right now to be kind of test driving these various tools that we'll use in order to manage our community. I think we're all really up for the challenge. We want to do it in the right way, do it in a way that really shows great respect for one another and also the mission of the college. We do believe that we're in a position to take good care of you. We do believe that we have the resources that we need and access to additional resources to provide the full complement of services to which you're accustomed. I always believe we're the right size. I love the size of the college because you can really be immediately attentive to needs as they develop. And then I just want to conclude by reminding you that if anything wants to be reheard or you want to seek additional insight, the entire telephone call will be posted to the website and you can access it there. With that, I think we're ready to conclude. Thank you so much for staying with us, and God be with you.
This concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.